Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Big Mac, fries, and a stolen paycheck. How about that? McDonald's and the business challenges of income inequality on the broadcast today. Target, the credit card hack that keeps on giving. And our series, You Hate My Job. Smile, everybody. We're going out with the paparazzi from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 13th of March today, and we are going to get going with two items about the American workforce. First of all, that part of the labor pool that currently doesn't have a job and hasn't for 6 months or more. There's word today of a deal in the United States Senate to restore long-term unemployment benefits, the ones that expired for 1.3 million people back at the end of last year, as you might remember. That number is up to 2 million. Now, and the deal, which does, of course, have yet to actually be passed in both the House and the Senate, would restore benefits retroactively to New Year's and go until the end of May. Elsewhere in labor politics, McDonald's has been sued. Employees say the fast food chain violated labor laws by failing to pay overtime and making them work off the clock. It's just the latest in a long, long stretch of bad publicity for McDonald's. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, the whole fast food industry is starting to notice.
What's novel about the lawsuits is the way they try to tar McDonald's and its valuable brand for alleged wage and hour violations at franchise restaurants it doesn't even own or directly run. Michael Rubin is one of the lawyers representing a group of McDonald's workers in California.
The McDonald's corporate entity was sued as well, both as a joint employer and as a principal agent, co-conspirator, negligent franchisor.
That responsibility will have to be proved, of course, with evidence like software McDonald's provides to monitor labor costs at its franchises. The company issued a statement today saying McDonald's and our independent owner-operators share a concern and commitment to the well-being and fair treatment of their employees. This is the last thing McDonald's and other chains want consumers thinking about, lawsuits and labor advocacy to boost wages. McDonald's said in a recent securities filing that the impact of campaigns to promote adverse perceptions of its brand and fast food in general were a risk to the business. Mary Chapman at food industry research firm Technomic.
Consumers want to do business with people who feel the way that they do about social issues. And so for some consumers, employment practices are very important. But for very many more consumers, it's more about price and convenience and quality.
Mark Brandau of Nation's Restaurant News says he's never seen as much attention paid to the labor issues around fast food before. Companies have to focus on it.
I'm sure that they would like to see these issues being settled, you know, in the political arena, not in their dining rooms.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Remember the Target hack? 70 million people who had credit card numbers and or personal data stolen? Yes, of course you do. How could you not? That breach helped send the stock down. It helped customers decide to stop shopping. And it made Target the target of a whole slew of lawsuits. Bloomberg Businessweek is reporting that Target had the latest and greatest software to protect itself against hackers. But when the alarm went off, they ignored it. And then when another alarm went off, they ignored that one too. Marketplace's Queen of Kim takes it from there.
It sounds sort of crazy, right? The burglar alarm goes off and you hit snooze? Anthony DiBello is with the cybersecurity firm Guidance Software, and he says it's more complicated than that. He says computer networks at large companies are constantly being hit with malware.
There's an indication that this isn't just a small number, 100 or 200. This is 10,000, 20,000 attempts against their networks every day.
An alarm goes off every time, but there are a lot of false alarms. Cameron Camp is a cybersecurity researcher with ESET. He says when it's not certain how serious an alarm is, companies aren't structured to make decisions quickly.
You have sort of silos. Over here is the C-suite, and over here is the IT guys, and once a week you have a meeting. And the reason for that is because IT used to just keep the gears running, but security is a business imperative now because it costs you a lot if it's done wrong for whatever reason.
He says most companies don't have a chief information security officer, and often there isn't a clear chain of command. Eric Goldman is a professor at the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University. He says regulators haven't clarified what companies need to do to keep consumers safe. On the one hand,
the Federal Trade Commission has pursued a number of companies that knew they didn't have adequate security.
But he says enforcement has been arbitrary, and right now there are no clear standards. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
I'd be lying if I said I knew what, but something was bugging Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whether it's your Netflix streaming or something more important, like moving electronic medical records from one place to another, say, the promise of the internet to come rests largely on something called gigabit connectivity, way faster than broadband, or so we are told. Google is starting to build the infrastructure for gigabit internet in a number of places. Kansas City was the first. Austin, Texas is one of the most recent. Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson has been down in Austin this week for South by Southwest. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so broadband I get, high speed I get. Talk to me for a second about gigabit internet. What is that?
Okay, so gigabit's sort of like broadband, use some of the same infrastructure, but it's like download an HD movie in like a couple seconds instead of 20 minutes.
All right.
So Google has been rolling out this service called Google Fiber, which is gigabit. The company requires an investment for the infrastructure, but in Kansas City, for instance, if you want regular high-speed internet, you can pay $300 to get a hookup at the house and help invest in that gigabit infrastructure, and then you're done paying for internet for 7 years, which, you know, sounds pretty darn good, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I'm paying what, $40 a month? You?
Yeah, just about the same. So, yeah, pretty reasonable.
You know, so residential makes sense, right? I mean, obviously, we all want fast movies. I imagine, though, the businesses have sort of different priorities, right?
Yeah, that's true. And Google Fiber rolled out in Kansas City in 2012, and there's been some evidence that they're being able to draw startups there. It also seems like Google thinks this is a good business idea. The company is now rolling this stuff out to 34 cities. It's in 9 different metro areas in the next several years. Atlanta, Salt Lake City, San Jose, Charlotte, these are on the list. But Austin applied for gigabit in 2010.
Yeah, so it's taken 4 years to get to Austin. What's it going to be like, you know, 4 years from now in places?
One place I visited while I was here is UT Austin's Stampede supercomputer. It's the 7th most powerful computer in the country. It's this giant room filled with Intel and Dell processors and servers and hard drives. They pump cold water through the floor to keep everything cold and through the server racks. Stampede has a 10 gigabit connection, so insanely fast.
Yeah.
It's processing things like weather, climate modeling, and some of that stuff couldn't be done even just a couple years ago. Yeah. Now, I don't know how big your house is, Kai, but I doubt you're going to fit Stampede in there.
Yeah, no, not going to happen.
But I did ask the director at the supercomputer about what gigabit internet might do to the way we use internet. And he said, you know, 5 years down the line, if we all have gigabit connections, think about television content being way more interactive. Like, you can maybe drive the narrative in some way or be part of the story in real time, which is kind of interesting.
Which would be cool, except I'm not hearing you say that Los Angeles is going to get that anytime soon in my neck of the woods, right?
I got bad news for both of us. New York, L.A., not on the list. So I guess you and I might have to be used to that pinwheel in our Netflix for a little while longer.
Ben Johnson, he's the host of Marketplace Tech. We got him down in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
we're providing a product. Do not yell. Don't get mad at me. Get mad at the people who buy it.
Don't shoot the messenger, y'all. A ride along with a paparazzo coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, I knew it was going to be the Wawa, so I will get straight to the gory details. The Dow Industrials threw off 231 points today. That's 231 points. 1.4% closed at 16,108. The NASDAQ let go of 62 points, also 1.4%. Finished at 4260. The S&P 500 traded down 21 points, 1.1%, ended at 1846. Strong economic data in the U.S. was no match for worries about China and Ukraine. Goldman Sachs ended 1.75% lower today. Citigroup erased 1.3%. United Technologies was down 2.5% after the company unveiled its financial outlook. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.64%. and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, First Lady Michelle Obama delivers the keynote address at a summit on childhood obesity. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Albert Einstein was born on March 14, 1879. And sticking with the math and science category, you need it to solve some of life's problems, like the area of a circle or the volume of a cylinder. What is pi? Tomorrow is Pi Day. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Ticker symbol HLF, Herbalife, is where we go next. Shares fell another 5.5% today after an even steeper drop yesterday on the Federal Trade Commission's announcement that it's going to investigate the nutritional supplement company. It is a fairly high-profile story, actually, mostly because of a very public spat between the company and investors who have bet against it, specifically a guy named William Ackman. He's a hedge fund manager. But more to the point, he's bet $1 billion on his belief that Herbalife is a pyramid scheme and that its shares will inevitably collapse. And he has been doing everything he can to make that happen. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains how this Wall Street melodrama might actually work.
It is one thing to bet a company is going to go down. That's called shorting.
Short selling is extremely common.
And that's Patrick Curtis with Wall Street Oasis. It is quite another to bet a company is going to go down and then do everything in your power to make it go down.
Okay, so we've got a lot to cover today, so we're going to move pretty quickly.
That is billionaire investor Bill Ackman doing a presentation to investors. He bet $1 billion against a company called Herbalife. And since then, he has done web presentations and hired lobbyists. He's appealed to governments from here to China, accusing Herbalife of being a pyramid scheme. Herbalife, of course, denies this. For Zachary Carabel with Investnet, investors like Ackman are
corporate raiders.
His point is they aren't trying to help the company get better. It's like betting against a horse and then shooting it.
You know, that's not really investing in a company for the long term in an active way for the benefit of all the other shareholders. It's basically riding a wave up or down as long as it's opportune for you.
Now, campaigning publicly against a company isn't illegal as long as it's transparent, and there are reasons it might not be such a bad thing, says Wall Street Oasis Patrick Curtis.
It does serve as a check and balance to companies that potentially are kind of walking that gray line between what's legal and what's not legal.
It could shine a light on a company that might be a bit shady, but it can also cause investors to panic over healthy companies, says Damian Park with Hedge Fund Solutions.
If you get a number of shorts piling into a stock, it will create its own death spiral.
Either way, this kind of public battle is rare. So grab some popcorn and watch the show. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are 105 historically black colleges and universities in this country, HBCUs for short. But the number is teetering on 104 because one of the smallest of them, Morris Brown College in Atlanta, has been struggling for a decade and time is running short. Jim Burris from WABE in Atlanta reports.
If HBCUs are an endangered species, Morris Brown College could be the closest to extinction. And its fall has been more than a decade in the making. Most buildings on this silent campus are boarded up and abandoned. Before the school lost accreditation in 2003, it enrolled a few thousand students. Almost overnight, most fled, fearful their degree would carry no weight. Today, there are just 35.
No, it's no excuse, but I'm only human.
26-year-old Jaquala Walker is one. The aspiring singer is the only student in this class called Promotions in Recorded Music. I ask her, why Morris Brown?
Why not Morris Brown? I mean, it deserves a chance just like everybody else do. And they want to help.
Jaquala's instructor is Makisha Funderburk. She wants to help so much so she teaches without pay.
I just think Morris Brown should be given a chance, and it's been done pretty well, surviving 10 years. And a lot of people are wondering why and how. So
the why is easier to answer than the how. Morris Brown has to survive. If it closes its doors, even for a short time, the school's land could go to nearby Clark Atlanta University. That's the school that originally donated the land. Dr. Stanley Pritchett is Morris Brown's president.
We are upholding a great tradition of former slaves, of people in the early 1900s that struggle to make certain that this institution will remain open.
Pritchett says Morris Brown survives because its entire history is one of hardship and triumph. He says the college has always been resourceful.
A church member down in South Georgia told me they used to have a campaign called Dollar Money. Everybody who came to the meeting brought a dollar for Morris Brown.
But Morris Brown needs $30 million to get out of debt. That's about $1 million for every current student. Time to turn out the lights and let nearby HBCUs step in? No, says alumnus Charles Barlow. When he started at Morris Brown, he says he brought with him a 550 on the SAT and read at a 10th grade level.
But Morris Brown accepted me in, took me through a remedial reading program to teach me how to read, because obviously if you can't read, you can't do college work. But I finished in 4 years in the top 10% of my class.
Barlow went on to become a top executive at Xerox for nearly 2 decades. His story is why he says Morris Brown must exit bankruptcy and rebuild. But how?
The biggest strengths they have is their property.
Mary Beth Gasman is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She led a graduate class that looked into options for saving the school.
And so the property is really the key to their livelihood and their success.
Lots of folks have eyed the school's land. It sits adjacent to the future site of Atlanta's new NFL stadium. 2 previous plans to sell part of the campus fell through, and efforts by outsiders to help the school haven't gone over very well.
Hands off!
Hands off!
Morris Brown!
But it turns out the college's land is its last best hope. A bankruptcy judge has given the green light to sell off about 85% of the school's property. President Stanley Pritchett says with that debt gone, Morris Brown can focus on building back its academics and hopefully attract as many students as it once did. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
We do an occasional series on this program about jobs that have a bad rap. It's called, simply enough, You Hate My Job. And we've done meter maids and bankruptcy lawyers and the people who work at the DMV. But today, one of the most notorious professions on the planet, paparazzi photographers. Our guide is one of the most successful guys in the game. His name is Giles Harrison. He's been snapping away for 17 years. He also runs a photo agency called London Entertainment Group that sells 1,000 pictures a year, which is a lot. We tagged along not too long ago as Giles drove his Cadillac Escalade on his usual morning route, starting out in Santa Monica, California.
How many hours a week do you spend in this car?
Far too damn many. At least 8 hours a day.
How did you get into this? How did it start?
You know, it's a weird way how it started. I had a buddy who owned a news agency, and one of the things they wanted to do was start a video department. So they were like, hey, you know, do you want to come and shoot video for us? I was between jobs, and it was just to tide me over till, you know, I found the next gig. So the first day I went out, shot some video, sold it for like $500. I was like, huh.
Not a bad way.
I can make $500 just for Pamela Anderson telling me to get a life on the set of Baywatch.
Hmm. Is that what it was?
Yeah, I swear to God.
Seriously?
My first day on the job, she leaned out the car window and said, get a life, you heads. I swear. And I was like, that's kind of been, you know.
And it just gets better from there.
Yeah.
Is this part of your route? Is this your regular?
This is part of my route. Because the thing you're trying to catch at this point is people working out, people getting coffee, people walking their dogs, doing all those morning kind of activities.
All right, but it's 9:45 in the morning. Aren't people, like, already into their days yet, or is this just Santa Monica
stuff? Well, you got to think. Celebrities aren't like normal people. They don't have to be at work at 9 o'clock.
Right. Is a celebrity doing almost anything worth you stopping and taking a picture?
Pretty much a celebrity doing almost anything is worth me stopping and taking a picture. I've taken a picture of somebody so much as plugging a parking meter.
You can actually see it now specifically, right? You can see the picture of, I don't know, Reese Witherspoon putting money in a parking meter.
Exactly.
And the caption of the thing is Reese Witherspoon on a shopping adventure in
exactly. It goes in the stars, they're just like us section. And any good journalist, if you got half a journalistic sense, you can take something and spin it.
I find it so, and I say this without trying to be pejorative at all.
No.
You fundamentally think you're doing journalism. You believe that?
Yeah, 100%. Huh. It's celebrity journalism. It's
right.
Fluff.
Right, but it's journalism. It's chronicling our times.
We're documenting the pop culture in which we live, and that's all it is. Hold on a second.
Oh. Now, how did you see that, first of all?
Because I'm looking, and I'm double-checking, because better to check it out and be wrong than not check it out and be right.
So what do you do? You're getting somebody to
I'm calling a friend I know who's around the corner.
All right.
Hey, Kaminsky, do me a favor. There's a motorcycle about to come past you. Let me know if it's you and McGregor.
Yeah, I will do.
You should be coming now.
Okay. He's just gone into Chase Bank.
You went into the parking lot of Chase?
Yeah, correct.
All right, let me cut through there and have a look.
All
right. Nah, it's not him.
How do you know? Where do you know?
Yeah, I know this guy. He kind of looks like I'm in the face a bit.
No worries. All right, my friend. All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Is it bad that I really wanted that to be you and McGregor?
No, I wanted it to be you, McGregor.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. In today's, you know, media environment, celebrities ought to be aware that they're being watched. But what do you make of the argument made by George Clooney and many others that you guys are just parasites?
How are we parasites?
Glomming off of their fame to make a buck.
Aren't they doing the same thing? When they want something promoted, aren't they inviting cameras in? There is a certain feeding off of that, but we're providing a product. Don't get mad at me. Get mad at the people who buy it.
So it's the consumer's fault, fundamentally.
Fundamentally, yeah, kind of. Because, you know, that's what drives the markets. But there's a lot of celebrities that don't have a problem with it. There's a lot of celebrities that sit there and say, okay, you know what, take a few pictures and go away.
And do you?
I do, right. Yeah.
All right.
But you know what? There's an element of photographers that want to get short-lensed and flash and be in a celebrity's face.
That is close,
and,
right?
And get close, up close, and personal. I try not to do that. If you don't see me, that's how I've done my job best, because that's how I'm not intruding, I'm not harassing, I'm not tormenting, which is all the aspects of the law that is now in effect.
You've got some experience with this, though, about the law saying what you can and can't do, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, 15 years ago, you and Arnold Schwarzenegger got into it.
Yeah, and I did my time in jail.
For, let's lay it out, for what? Misdemeanor, false imprisonment, right?
Misdemeanor, false imprisonment.
Right.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, who at the time was, you know, big, buff, healthy guy,
yep,
just had heart surgery. There was magazines clamoring for the first pictures of him post-op. And, you know, I was young and green, and I was hungry for a story. If I had to do it again, would I have done it differently? 100%, I would have done it completely different. I would never have chased the guy in his car. I would never have confronted him. That was a pretty bad day.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to find out that, you know, you're the most wanted person in Santa Monica, and you end up doing 39 days in the slam.
Price tag a good shot for me. If that had been you and McGregor back there,
you know, a couple hundred bucks. I mean, Ewan McGregor is nothing special, but it would have been, you know, nice shots of Ewan McGregor on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Which you could have sold to freaking, you know, Auto Week.
Wow.
You know, celebs in their motorcycles. To get a decent shot, you could even call up a brand manager and go, hey, you want a picture of a celebrity using your product? And a lot of that goes on as well. You know, there's brands that team up with celebrities that sit there and go, hey, if you get photographed by the paparazzi wearing these shoes, we will pay you
$10,000.
Really? Yeah, of course.
Wow.
100%.
I'm so naive.
It's advertising.
So this is the entire consumer marketing society in one paparazzi photograph?
Pretty much. There was a time, like in the early 2000s, when you'd get pictures and regularly you'd be selling them for like thousands of dollars.
Wow.
Especially when Us Weekly and People Magazine were competing against each other. I sold a picture of Faith Hill drinking a milkshake at Johnny Rockets for 10 grand.
Man.
Wouldn't get that now.
How come? What's changed?
Blogs. You know, the immediacy of news now. Before, you'd have to wait a week for a story to break in a magazine.
Yeah.
Now it can be out in
minutes.
An hour
and a half, right.
It's not even that long.
Yeah.
I can transmit something to somebody, and it can be around the world in the breaking story inside of 5-10 minutes. Hello?
Hey, Ellen.
Hey, what's up?
Are you like Ben's flight in charge, are you?
I can be. Why? What's going on?
It's just Zach Galifianakis at Rose Cafe as well.
Zach Galifianakis at Rose Cafe? Yeah, you know what? I'll pass.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Call ended.
Why'd you pass on Zach?
Can't give him away.
Really? That's pretty funny.
It's what we colloquially refer to in the industry as Jamba Juice money.
That's just so cold. Not worth my time. Do you like this job?
Yeah. You know, there's aspects of it that, like, I think like any job, you know, you have good days, you have bad days. I mean, I've been spit on. I've had people call me every name in the book. Some are not so racially sensitive names. People, you know, that said things about my mother. Just really nasty, hateful stuff. Whereas if I turned around and said the same thing to them, I'd be vilified.
Sounds like a lose-lose deal.
Yeah. But like
so tell me again why you do this job?
because I make good money.
Yeah, there you go.
I get paid. That's why I do it. You know, it's my job.
I know you're wondering if we saw any celebrities, minus the Ewan McGregor lookalike, of course, and poor Zach Galifianakis. We did, actually. We've got a video of the ride-along on our website. It's marketplace.org. Head over there. You can find out who it was.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which Amazon hints that possibly, maybe, who knows, but it could be that Amazon has decided just being the biggest seller of stuff online isn't enough. You gotta make a profit, too. The company announced this morning, in what you can only call a long-awaited move, that its $79 Amazon Prime service will henceforth be its $99 Amazon Prime service. The phrase you're looking for here is loss leader. Even at $99, Prime is a bargain for shoppers, and it works out well for Amazon, too. One estimate has Prime customers spending $1,340 a year on that site. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hearst, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.